Okay, please welcome everybody to our Buddhist Center here in Nolimara. And first of all, let me say with full sincerity how privileged I feel to be invited to give this talk from the gay community of Western Australia, the gay, lesbian, transgender community, on Buddhist ideas about homosexuality. And it's because, I don't know if he's here today, but one of the leading members of the gay, lesbian, transgender community in Perth. I think he comes here mostly on a Friday evening. I met him once when I gave a talk at Mercy Hospital, and he came and listened. And what he said afterwards was one of those moments which really went right into my heart and made me feel very sad. Because when he said that religion has been very cruel to the gay, lesbian, transgender community. And I always remember that saying and always felt like crying afterwards. Religion should never be cruel to anybody. Because the whole idea of spirituality, as far as I understand it, is like giving peace, harmony, kindness and love towards people of all genders. And even a part of my life as a monk, especially the middle years of my life when I first came over here, I spent a lot of time going into the prisons of Western Australia and talking to murderers and rapists. And if you could love people like that, who actually have hurt others, why on earth can't you sort of love gay and lesbian transgenders who have done no harm to anybody whatsoever? So because of that, I'm very happy to have a crusade, a jihad against gender discrimination, but obviously a non-violent one. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Buddhist attitudes to homosexuality and other such issues. And what is actually striking, first of all, like my qualifications, I've been a monk for 32 years and well known as a teacher, not just in Australia but in other countries as well. But it's not just my training in meditation. I've also done a lot of scholastic research, especially my, again, early years as a monk, when I learnt Pali, which is a language of the Buddhist scriptures of our tradition. Pali is like a dialect of Sanskrit. So you can go back to the original sources and actually find out exactly what the Buddha said, and especially about, you know, homosexuality. And what you find in there was the stunning silence. In other words, it was not an issue for Buddhism at all. Even though it was, as you all know, everybody knows, that homosexuality, transgender, lesbian issues have not just suddenly appeared. They've been part of all of our cultures from time immemorial. And in India, where Buddhism started, they were mentioned there. They were mentioned as just human beings like any other beings and not discriminated against in any which way. The only time in the ancient Buddhist scriptures which they were really mentioned was when it came to ordaining as a monk. Now, I think when I was invited to, I think last year, the gay pride breakfast at Curtin University, I mentioned there that actually I am more deviant than any of you. I'm celibate. And that's actually more deviant than being gay, lesbian or transsexual in our society. And because of celibacy, I'm saying deviant because a lot of people don't accept sort of, you know, the asexuality of a monk or a nun. And interestingly, in Thailand, where I spent my first 9 years as a monk, and Thailand accepts homosexuality, there's no problem there at all. Part of the community, no discrimination whatsoever. I don't know if you saw that movie, which was, I think that Iron Ladies, I remember what it was called in Thai, about a gay, was it basketball or volleyball team? Volleyball team, okay, you saw it. A volleyball team in Thailand who were so good, I think they won some championship. And that really sort of surprised people. But they obviously, that they were really good. And I think a film was made of it afterwards, just to show the tolerance which was in Thailand then. But the only time the Buddha mentioned this was if a person becomes a monk, obviously if they have sexual attraction to other men living in an all-male community, which is supposed to be celibate, there can be a problem. But in my monastery, we have some monks who have lived a gay lifestyle. The thing is, once you become a monk, obviously you can't be sexually active. That's the only difference there. And so in our monastic rules, they say a gay person can become a monk, a lesbian can become a nun, as long as they can suppress their sexual urges to live a life of celibacy. And that's the only mention there in Buddhism about any restrictions whatsoever, like about in the gay and lesbian community, simply because it's just impractical to have sexual relationships if you're supposed to be celibate. And we do have a separation there between the genders in our monastic tradition. As you may know, that we have a nun's monastery over in Gijiganup. Our monk's monastery is over in Serpentine. The reason we have a separation there is because a lot of people think that monks and nuns, if they live together, that when everyone goes home, they're in each other's beds. And the reason, one of the jokes which I remember hearing from my father, who was from Liverpool, and this was about 40 years ago, he used to come along and say, "What fun does a monk have?" You know the answer? None. So because people think like that, you know, we have to, if you're a monk, you are really celibate, and so we can't have nuns in the same place because people think what happens in the evenings. But obviously, if there's a person who has lived a gay lifestyle before, they too can become a monk as long as they can show themselves they're not going to be sexually active when they're celibate. In the Buddhist tradition, if you are a monk, you don't have to be a monk forever. So any monk, whether they are straight or whether they are gay, that if they find they cannot handle the celibacy, you know, it's too tough for them, then they leave and there's no problem there at all. So just because you're a monk, you're not a monk forever. You're a monk as long as you find it useful and rewarding. So whatever vows you take are never for life, because people change. We allow that change to happen. Now I mention that because that's the only thing which is talked about in Buddhism. And because it's not talked about there, and because it's obviously there was mentioned knowledge of homosexuality, it was the best non-discrimination. Not even talking about it. Not because of fear, but it wasn't an issue anymore. And the reason it's not an issue anymore, and I think the reason why it never has been an issue in the Buddhist religion, is because the way that the Buddhism is organized is without any hierarchy. And I think it's whenever there's a hierarchy and people in power, then that is usually the problems where people get into dogmatism, power trips, fear, oppression. And I think that's what many in the gay and lesbian community have experienced over many, many hundreds of years. Because when the Buddha died, passed away, before he passed away, that people asked him, said, "Once you're passed away and gone, who will take over from you? Who will be the leader?" And one of the most amazing, for me anyway, answers were, "No one will be the leader after me. Just let the truth be your teacher from now on." And what that meant was there was no hierarchy. People try to establish hierarchies from now and again. You know, that we have like a Dalai Lama, but he has no power, only the power which the Tibetan tradition actually give him out of respect. But, you know, he is not a leader, he's not a supreme pope or a patriarch. And he can't be, because every tradition knows those last words of the Buddha, you can't establish a leader, a boss. And the reason is, it's something fundamental why the Buddha said that. Because the truth is not what you're told. The truth doesn't lie in books or in leaders or in some external authority. From the very beginning, the Buddha realized the truth lies in every individual. Basically, you know what's right and what's wrong. And any religious leader, all their job is to clear away any misconceptions so people can see the truth for themselves. Not to tell you what to believe, but to show you how to trust yourselves. And that empowerment of those spiritual traditions, I think, is one of the wonderful things that we can offer to all people, no matter what your gender preferences are, no matter what your race, no matter what you do. It's an empowering of you to say, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to tell you what not to do. But I'm going to help you, if you want to, find out how to understand how you feel and what is something which will create happiness for yourself and happiness for others. Because basic Buddhist morality, and it's a fascinating concept, the ethics of Buddhism. We do have precepts. With a Buddhist Savar tradition, we have 5 precepts. And the sexual precept is number 3, and it's just no sexual misconduct. And sexual misconduct does not mean you can't have anal sex or oral sex or genital sex or whatever. Sexual misconduct is just so you're not harming or hurting the other person. Especially by breaking the trust of a relationship by going having a sexual relationship with somebody else. So the only part of the Buddhist virtue for the lay community is to make sure that you don't abuse the trust of your partner. And if you do abuse that trust by sleeping with someone else, by having relationships with someone else, then you do break your precepts. It is gender unspecific. And that's the basic precept. Oh, sorry, it's not the basic precept, it's the secondary one. Because underneath that, there's a principle which underlies Buddhist virtue and helps people understand what's right and what's wrong, which is never do anything which harms another human being. Never do anything which harms yourself. A lot of the time people think those are separate rules, but really they are exactly the same. Because what harms you harms the people who love you. What harms other people, it does harm you when you see you're creating pain. And I was straight before I was a monk. Now I'm celibate. I've been fortunate since I've become a monk to have many friends who are gay, lesbian, transgender, and I really respect them, and they've taught me a lot. And I can't, there's no harm, you know, you're not harming anybody by being a gay person or being a straight person. So basically for me it's what's the big deal? However, whether you are straight or whether you're in a gay lifestyle, the most important thing is don't create harm. So if you have a partner, please care for them, just as you like to be cared for yourself. And respecting your lifestyle, respecting my lifestyle, respecting other people's lifestyle, I think it's very important to make a statement to give freedom to people to follow their lifestyle, you know, without harm. Even when people do create harm, for example, you know, you do find another guy you like and you sort of have a quick relationship with them. Even so, the basic laws of compassion and kindness, which is at the heart of all religions, is also an incredible amount of forgiveness. So if you have a partner and he strays, please forgive them. Because otherwise, what actually happens is that you've had a wonderful time together and they do one stupid thing and you break this relationship. The idea of a relationship is something which allows the other person to make mistakes. A good example of this from a straight relationship. Lady over in Kuala Lumpur, after I gave a talk, asked a question after I finished my talk. She said her partner, she was in a straight relationship, her husband had lied to her. She said, I can't trust him anymore. Or should I get divorced? She said. So I asked her, number one, how long have you been married? She said, 3 years. Number two, what do you do? What's your job? and she was actually a lecturer in maths at the university. So I saw my opportunity to teach her. I said, if you teach maths, you should know some statistics. So let's do some statistics together. You've been married to your husband for 3 years. That's about 1,000 days. Let's assume that every day that your husband has said 20 things which could be right, which could be wrong. That's, you know, it's an assumption, but it's a reasonable assumption. So since you've been together, he said 20,000 things to you, which could be right and could be wrong. And this is the first time he's lied. So according to probability theory, the next time he opens his mouth, there's a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? And they can understand the logic of that. Why is it in a relationship, somebody makes a mistake once, and that's all we remember? We don't remember all the times they've been committed to us, kind to us, gentle to us, sensitive to us, honest to us. So don't break up your relationship just because one or two faults. Your relationship is too precious for that. And this is actually what we mean by non-harming and having ability to forgive, to accept, to embrace even the mistakes of others. And if we can do that, we have a solid idea of what forgiveness is all about, acceptance and embracing, which is more than just virtue, more than telling you what you shouldn't do, more than telling you, or rather encourage you, what to do in your life. So we can actually have a much stronger relationship between each other. And basically, that's as far as ideas of virtue go in Buddhism. So we don't say this is wrong, that is wrong, you can't do this, you shouldn't do that. It's basically we say if it's going to harm someone or harm yourself, then there's something wrong with that. You're creating more hurt and pain in this world. And understanding that, you can actually gay lifestyle. Well, who's that harming? Who's that hurting? Answer, no one. So what's wrong with it? Nothing. And so I use that criteria and I teach that criteria, Buddhists use that criteria, to any type of lifestyle, any type of actions. Is it harming? Is it hurting? And this is straight from the mouth of the Buddha when he told this to his son in the Rahulavada Sutra. So whatever you do in your life, understand, is it hurting? Is it harming? Which is why people I've talked to who've been living a gay lifestyle, they think, what's the big problem? There's nothing wrong with this. It doesn't feel wrong, does it? And a lot of time, if you actually go to your feelings inside, you know if it feels wrong, if it feels right, if you're honest inside yourself. And this is, I think, one of the big problems, which I may be wrong because I'm talking as an outsider. A lot of people in the gay community feel very frustrated, because they know there's nothing wrong with their gay lifestyle and they're just being themselves. But a lot of our community outside says there's something wrong and they feel this either guilt trip put on them, this tension put on them, and they think, what's the problem? You know, people want to do the right thing. You know it's right, but people tell you it's wrong. And that's a conflict there. So one thing I can tell you, there's nothing wrong with the gay lifestyle. But it's up to people like me to keep up talking, promoting, telling people that, listen, stop pulling your trips on people who've had enough pain already. Give everybody a break in this life and stop trying to control other people according to your own bigotry. When it comes down to it, religion should be giving freedom to people, as I said at the beginning. Freedom, even if people do harm others, that's their decision. In the end, you have to trust people to try and encourage and teach them to do the right thing. A lot of time to trust that inner gut feeling. One of the moving anecdotes, which really meant a lot to me, and it's very illuminating, because I was born about 55 years ago, and I was in Thailand during the Vietnam War. That Vietnam War was an important, if you like, part of my history. And I do remember, I never served obviously in an army because I came from England. They weren't part of the Vietnam War. But I went to the United States, met many people who were in the front line. And many of my friends who were monks also did fight in Vietnam. And obviously it was a very traumatic time for them, being in an army, being ordered to kill. But the anecdote which I found very important was something which happened, an atrocity, a war crime, called the My Lai Massacre. Many of you may remember those words, My Lai. The officer in charge was a guy called Lieutenant Calley, C-A-L-L-E-Y, I still remember his name. I don't know if he took orders from above, but he was the officer in command, and they ordered that all the troop of soldiers, maybe 100 or more, to go into a village in Vietnam called My Lai and to indiscriminately kill every man, woman and child without any exception. That was their order. Everybody was to be killed. And they did that. I think one or two people survived, as you always do, ran away, actually, to tell people what had happened. That was like a war crime. You can't do such things and get away with it. There's always somebody who lets on what happened. And obviously that was a very big scandal for the US government. Hit the newspapers, and I think Lieutenant Calley was put in jail. But 25 years afterwards, there was a TV documentary made where some enterprising reporter traced as many of those soldiers as he could find, to find out the aftermath 25 years on. And he came to some very interesting discoveries. He said most of the soldiers who had participated in that atrocity could not have a relationship with anybody. They were into drugs and alcohol. Socially, they were very dysfunctional. Imagine carrying that pain in your heart of what you've done, something you can never remember, you never forget. There's always a couple of exceptions which are the most interesting part of any research. And the most prominent exception was an African-American soldier who had refused to go in, who stood his ground and said to his commanding officer, "No, I'm not going to do this." As a result of disobeying that order, he was put in military jail for 2 or 3 years. Now, many of you may have seen documentaries or read books about American jails. They're far more sadistic than Australian jails. And military jails are even worse. This African-American soldier, when he was interviewed, he knew what was going to happen to him by refusing 2 or 3 years in a tough, hard jail for just standing his ground and not doing something which he thought was wrong. But as a result of that, he was the only person, or one of the only people, who had a good relationship, was happy, was at ease with himself. And when the reporter asked him, "How could you do that? How could you refuse an order knowing the consequences were going to be so tough on you? Are you some sort of philosopher?" His background was someone born in a ghetto who joined the army just to get out of that terrible lifestyle. As many American soldiers do. They're no-hopers who join the army as a way out of their poverty or their crime-based communities. That's why he joined. He had very little education. But he said when the order came in to go in and shoot men, women and children, he said he just couldn't do it. His gut told him it was wrong. He'd never been taught this. He wasn't particularly religious. He just knew it was wrong. Do you need a religion to tell you that that's wrong? Of course not. He knew it was wrong. He trusted in that feeling. He did suffer for 2 or 3 years, but he's been happy for 30 years. So that's the sort of person I respect. He's got his just rewards of happiness and well-being. The point is, you don't need a religion, not even Buddhism, to tell you what's right and wrong. You don't need Christianity to tell you anything, Buddhism or Islam or whatever. You know what's right and wrong. The job of religion is empower you to trust that feeling. It's not to treat you like slaves or children and say, do this and do that. You're not sort of primary school kids. But why is it that people treat you like such? Job of religion is to empower, not to order or tell. Unfortunately, that if you empower people, you lose the power of your hierarchies. So hierarchies don't like to give people freedom. They like to have dogma and they like to have rules which they can punish and induce fear in people. To tell you, if you don't do this, you'll go to hell. And that way of fear is something which certainly I rebelled against as a teenager. I can't, if any God or any higher being is kind or compassionate, how can you ever send anybody to any hell or punish anybody? I know from experience now as a monk that punishment just has no place in the growth of a human being, but actually restricts their growth. It stunts them. You don't punish anybody for faults. You reward them for their successes. I was a school teacher for 1 year before I became a monk. As I tell people, teaching in a high school is enough to make anyone become a monk. But while I was there teaching, I learned a lot. And one of the things which I learned was something called positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. Unfortunately, in our communities, especially schools, you know how it works. You've all been to school. If you make a mistake, you're punished. If you do something right, oh, that's okay. It's just passed over. And that's why people get stunted. Another way of education, which was proved again and again and again, but people just don't take the time to follow it, is you never punish when someone makes a mistake. If you get the question wrong, you never give a black mark or detention or whatever. If you make a mistake, absolute forgiveness, completely ignored. When you make it right, you do something good, you are rewarded. You're given positive reinforcement, which means the qualities you want to see in somebody else get encouraged. So, in your relationships there, never blame your partner if they make a mistake. When they do something kind and good, which you really like and appreciate, give them a big hug. Whatever it is to reinforce that behavior which you like to see in them. Even recently, when I was in US last year, the end of last year, someone told me that a guy over there was making a fortune potty training young pets. Because if you have a small little dog or a little cat in your house, you've got to train them to sort of poo and wee in the right place. Not on the carpet, not on the couch. So over in New York, they were trying to take, what he did, he guaranteed, with quite a lot of money, in 3 days I'll potty train your pets to always poo or wee outside. And what do? You take the pet outside, or his other workers, take him outside to the park or to the nearest tree. And he'd wait there until they did their poo, their shit, or their urination on the tree. And as soon as they did it on the tree, he'd do somersaults, jump up in the air, be exuberant, sing a happy song, just to make the dogs realize they'd done something good. And it worked a treat. In 3 days, those dogs, or those little kittens, would only poo, only shit, or pee outside. It's positive reinforcement. And this guy had a business, he was making a fortune. But apparently, I also heard, later on, I heard this in New York, and someone told me in San Fran, that the guy was actually having a bit of problems now. Because some of the pets which he trained in this way were in the house when their owners were watching the football on the TV. And suddenly their team scored a goal and they shouted and you know what their pets did. But it does actually show the power of positive conditioning. And so I've taken that on board, certainly in Buddhism, and it's part of Buddhism. We don't have punishments in Buddhism. We don't even have guilt in Buddhism. It's a word which is just not in the old Sanskrit. It's like almost like an English word. What do you feel guilty about anyway? Does that really help? You've done nothing wrong, even if we have done something wrong. If you feel guilty about it, you're liable to repeat the mistake in the future. If you forgive it, it's gone, and you're not likely to make a mistake in the future. So we don't have punishment in Buddhism. Even there was a postulant, like a trainee, come to my monastery some years ago. He'd made a mistake. He'd broken a rule. I think he'd ate something in the afternoon. We're not supposed to do that as monks. We developed quite an austere lifestyle. So he came to me to confess. Like, I was the abbot, so nominally in charge. But I often get outvoted by the other monks, as you know. So, because it's like a democracy. If we have a decision to make, we take a vote on it. And if my side loses, it doesn't matter if I'm the abbot and been there for a long time, I get outvoted. So I'm not really the boss. It's no power trip. It's usually I'm the slave. We just had a 3-month rest period. You know what a rest period means? It means the rest of them do nothing while I have to do all the work. But anyway, this one trainee monk, he came and confessed this terrible thing he did. It was only a small thing, for goodness sake, but, you know, he felt terrible about it. So I said, look, forgive yourself, just don't do it again, that's all. You're a good person. But he wouldn't take that. He wanted some sort of penance. He demanded a penance. So I had to do some quick thinking. Because, you know, we're not really into punishing, but, you know, I thought, this is Australia. What's a typical traditional Australian punishment? I'd just been reading a history book. So I thought, okay, I told him, he was sitting right in front of me, I said, okay, if you want a punishment, I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. He went white. He thought, my goodness, I'm going to get whipped. But then I explained what 50 strokes of the cat is in the Buddhist tradition. In our monastery, we've got 3 cats. Find that cat and stroke it 50 times. Learn some compassion, you stupid person. Because when you learn some compassion by stroking a cat, maybe you can have the same compassion and kindness to yourself, and don't be so hard upon yourself. Have a bit of forgiveness and kindness. But I've always noticed that such forgiveness and such openness, you only find that in traditions which don't have hierarchies. It's a strange thing, but when it's a hierarchy, there's power trips, and people want to impose their power through fear. And the only way you can impose it through fear is have some system of punishment. Now, I'm obviously being a bit of an amateur sociologist there, but I think there's some truth to that. So hopefully, even in the gay and lesbian community, keep it loose. Don't have a hierarchy. Don't have, you know, the head gay of WA. If you have that, there's going to be problems for sure. So keep it loose. And if you keep it loose, you'll find that there's no even means to actually enforce these power trips. And when they have power trips, there is fear, there is punishment, and there is all the worst parts of religion. And I think that as soon as religions, whether it's Christianity or Islam, stop in the power trips and are there not to tell people what to do, just to serve, to help, to be friends, to lead the way in peace and compassion and kindness, I think we might have a much better world and a freer world. You know that one of the things which my father, this is actually, some of you have read the first book which I wrote, which is called Opening the Door of the Heart. And the title of that book came from one of the most meaningful stories of my life. And it's a nice little story to end this little talk and then start to open up for questions and answers. One of the things which changed the way I looked at life was when I was about 13 or 14. My father took me aside and said something which was about to change my life. My father was a very poor man. He was born in Liverpool, and after the Second World War, he just hitchhiked to London to get a job. But he was always very sickly. So because of that, you know, he never actually could really hold down a job for very long. So I grew up in what we call in London a council flat, a small apartment which was owned by the local government, you know, in a poor part of Acton, West London, and that's where I grew up. So he was a very poor man, but he was actually abused as a child. His father, who was a plumber in Liverpool during the Depression years, any money he got from his job, he spent in the pub, come home drunk, take off his belt, and whip any kid who came in his path, and then start on his wife, my father's mother. Whenever I talked about my grandfather to my father just ended the conversation by saying, that guy was a bastard. If you can imagine being born and living in a household like that, where the father was always whipping you for nothing. And the worst thing, he said, he could take the beatings himself, but seeing his mother beaten like that was just almost too hard to take. But he said that whenever he was on the end of that belt, he always thought, if ever I grow up, get married and have children, I would never do that. He never did. You know, he just could not beat us if we did something wrong. Could you remember what it was like? So it's an interesting case of someone who is subject to really gross domestic abuse or child abuse, not revisiting it on his kids, but actually learning from it, understanding it, and becoming just completely the opposite, being kind and gentle. On this particular occasion, he took me aside when I was about 13. He said, son, whatever you do in your life, always remember this. The door of my house will always be open to you. What was most important was whatever you do, wherever you go. As a 13-year-old, that meant something to me, but I didn't really understand it. I needed years as a monk to remember that. I knew it was important, I didn't know why. And I started thinking about it. As I said, his house was a small council flat. In fact, we were so poor that my father would often leave the door open, wouldn't lock it. We weren't afraid of burglars. In fact, we hoped burglars would actually come in, take pity on us, and leave something. So he didn't mean the door of his house. What he meant, and what really changed my life, was to say, whatever you do, wherever you go, the door of my heart will be open to you. And that was the amazing explanation of what love really means. To say to another person, whoever you are, whatever you do, there's something which is much greater than judging or criticizing you. Wherever you go, whatever you do, the door of my heart is always open. I'll always be your friend. I'll always be your lover even. Whatever you do, wherever you go. And that was something which really moved me. Which showed me something really spiritual and divine, if you like. You know, in what a true relationship is. A father's love for his son was completely unconditional. And that unconditional love should be at the heart of all religions. Not a critical love and saying, I'll love you if, but a love which has no boundaries, has no demands, has no expectations, will love you no matter what. I know at least one or two people here have yet to come out to their parents. Isn't that a sad indictment that parents still don't understand what love is? Wouldn't it be wonderful if parents would be able to say to their kids, what do you mean that you're gay, you're not gay? That doesn't matter. You're my son, you're my daughter. That's what's important. And to say to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, even if you're a rapist, even if you're a murderer, I don't like that, but still, the door of my heart's always open to you. There's something bigger, something greater. And that was actually what changed me as a monk made you more open. So I don't care who comes in here, then no matter who I meet on the street. Even the dog barking. Dear dog, the door of my heart's open to you as well. Been barking very often here. Now that's like a spirituality which I really respect. And I think that's what I invite any member of the gay, lesbian, transgender community to say to your partner. Whoever you are, wherever you go, whatever you do, the door of my heart's always open to you. What a wonderful thing it is to stay. But there's more. Because one thing which I only understood much later when I was a monk was always to say those same words one day to yourself. Whoever I am, whatever I do, whatever anybody else says about me, I don't care. The door of my heart is open to myself. To love yourself, who you are. Don't try and change. To accept your beauty as you are. And if you have faults, that's actually what makes you nice. If you were perfect, your partner would never be able to stand you. So the little faults and little things, that's what makes you human and lovable. So be able to say that to yourself. Don't try and get rid of your faults. Embrace them. Love yourself for who you are. And then you find they're not faults anyway. They're just features of yourself. And then you feel at ease with yourself. And you can spread that to other people. They'll be at ease with you. And spread that to our society. So they can be at ease with all the different lifestyles which people live in this great big world. Whatever religion anybody wants to follow, whatever philosophy, whatever path, as long as you're not really harming other people or harming yourself, just go for it. And always say, I will be your friend. So that's, in essence, I've tried to say in essence, you know, Buddhism and homosexuality, or spiritualism and homosexuality, or spiritualism and everything, I think is encompassed in those words, the door of my heart is always open. To me, to you, whoever, no matter what you ever do, or where you ever go. So, I've spoken for over 50 minutes already. Now's the time for some questions and answers. Has anyone got anything they'd like to ask? Do I have to? I did say this last night in the talk. I give a lot of talks in many places to different groups. And sometimes it's hard to get the first question. So I tell the following story from basic Buddhism. You know that Buddhists believe in karma and reincarnation? That's the basic Buddhism. And in one ancient teaching of the Buddha, he actually gave us an answer to certain things about reincarnation. He said, you know, why is it that some people are born wealthy? Or, you know, they work and they just make money easily. And other people, you work so hard and you're still poor. You work hard on those rich guys and you still don't make it. Why is it that some people are wealthy and some people aren't? What's the karmic cause behind that? And also, the Buddha actually said, why are some people born beautiful and other people born ugly? As I said last night, you may notice when I say ugly, I always look at the floor. I never look at anybody. Because once I did that, and she said, Ajahn Brahm, why were you looking at me when you said that word ugly? I'm into big trouble. But more importantly, the Buddha said, why it is that some people are born intelligent in the next life, while other people will be reborn stupid. And the Buddha said, this is the Mahakamavibhanga Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya, I quote it, just I'm not making this up. The Buddha said, the reason why people are born stupid in their next life is because they do not ask questions in this life. Any questions? You've got a chance. Yeah, thank you. Okay. I hope you looked in the West Australian newspaper, because I wrote a letter to the editor there criticizing the Dalai Lama. I said, you can't say that. Basically, I think I opened the letter by saying the Dalai Lama is out of line saying this. There's nothing in Buddhism which is critical of homosexuality. He's made a mistake, but I forgive him. But the point is, I also mentioned the Dalai Lama is not the Pope of Buddhism. And so what he says may be interesting, but it's not an authority. And interestingly, I got into big trouble with that. Many in the Tibetan Buddhist community were very upset with me for saying that. But I'm going to still carry on doing that, because there's no authority in Buddhism who you should not criticize when it's worthy of criticism. And even criticize me. If I make a mistake, I'm not a Pope or a Dalai Lama. And same with your partner. If you make a mistake, you get criticism. That's part of life. And sometimes you listen to criticism, my goodness, I have made a mistake, I'm sorry. But the Dalai Lama apparently is going to be coming to Perth in June. So, you know, being like a leader of the Buddhist community here, I will obviously have an opportunity to speak with him. And I ask him, see what he's doing. And just to tell him how much such comments hurt. So he shouldn't say things like that. There's no justification for it in the Buddhist scriptures. Not only that, but it's a sloppy way of speaking, and you've hurt a lot of people. So basically, it's not that I disagree with it, but I'm actively fighting against that one. Because I'm a Buddhist, and it's not what I believe. It's not what the Buddha said. It's out of line. Yeah. No, it was... I've heard of some of his statements before, but there was an article, I think it was in March or April in the West Australian. It was a reprint of an article from the Daily Telegraph in London. So the authenticity of the statements, you know, is not really questioned. The Dalai Lama obviously said that. Otherwise, the Daily Telegraph would be sued for everything. And he said that if you want to be a Buddhist, you cannot be a homosexual. What does he say? Full stop, I think he said. He was wrong, yeah. Correct, yeah. That's right, yeah. And so, you look at that, what he said, what justification have you? There's nothing in the Buddhist scriptures to support it. And if you want to sort of say, well, maybe they didn't know about anal sex, that's obviously wrong, because that's certainly mentioned in the scriptures. This is for monks. For monks, it is wrong to have anal sex with a man, with a woman, with a dog, anything, because you're a monk, you're celibate. So it's rules of celibacy. But that's only because you've taken a vow of non-sex. And it's not a one for life. If you don't like that, disrobe and do whatever you want. But to say that applies to non-monks or non-nuns is not true. And then you ask yourself, you know, is that harming or hurting? Well, it's obviously not. And it's just the way, as in a gay couple, you can express your intimacy together. So you know yourself it's okay. So whoever tells you opposite, if it's me or any authority, trust yourselves. So this is actually what religion is supposed to be about. Not telling you what to do, but empowering you, encouraging you, freeing you. Religion should be about liberation and freedom, not about putting people in more boxes. And I found that the more you liberate and free people, the less they harm each other. If you tell people, look, this is an old story, that in Jerusalem, I don't know, about 10 years ago, the doctors went on strike for more pay. So people, actually they walked out of the hospitals, and there was only like a few nurses, a few strike breakers that actually were looking after the patients. But in those 2 weeks when the doctors went on strike, the death rate in those hospitals plummeted. More people survived. So much for doctors. I don't see any doctors here. But to me, there's a little bells ring there. When you don't intervene and leave people alone, a lot of the time, obviously in emergencies, you know, people will die. A lot of the time, we just stir things up. We make things worse too often. And religion is famous for stirring things up, getting involved and making things worse. A real religion, real spirituality should be freeing people. Liberating them. Door of my heart's open to you no matter what you do. That's not putting you in a cage, is it? That's giving you freedom. And whatever you do, you'll always have a friend. What does that do to people? That makes people live up to such friendship. Don't want to kill anybody when you hear things like that. So the Dalai Lama was out of line. And actually that's what he said. But he's obviously wrong. He's made a mistake. Is that okay with you? Is that okay, Lincoln? I think it's... Is it on the web? Because you're a webmaster. Is it still on the website? Okay, yeah. I don't know. It gets all complicated. But yeah, he's coming in June. So maybe if I'll ask him if he gives any public talks. Maybe you ask him. Go up there and say, you know, is this right? So we have two intelligent people for the next life. Number three, yes. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Correct. It is. Sometimes the traditions have imposed a hierarchy. But you know, the type of Buddhism which I followed was the Theravada tradition. It was in Thailand. In Thailand they have a Sangharaja, but he's only got the power which the government gives him. But many of the monks say, look, according to our basic monastic rule, you know, it's up to us to do this or to do that. You can't have any power at all. In fact, it's the community has the power, the community of monks. So we can outvote the head monk of Thailand very easily. And naturally the monk sitting next to me, Osana, you've been ordained for 2 years now, haven't you? And just you've seen times when I've been outvoted in the Sangha? On books, is it? Yeah. Because when we have any vote on things, we have 22 monks at our monastery now, we put up something, a suggestion, and say, what do you want to do? Even simple things, you know, these are our winter robes covering our shoulder. And it's coming warm now, so we actually change our robes over to summer robes. And when we actually change them, I don't say, right from today on we change, we have a vote on it. And, you know, the winner, most monks, they actually win. And there has been times when I've been outvoted, many times. I remember those. Perhaps because I was outvoted, I remember them more than anybody else. But when we have Buddhism, I think in Vietnam, because it was colonized by the French, and sometimes the Buddhism adopts the colonial model, especially from Catholicism, because that was seen as powerful, maybe to say modernize Buddhism, they imposed hierarchies. That's actually where the Thai idea of a Sangharaja came from. It was from King Mongkut, about 120 years ago, who wanted to modernize Buddhism on Western principles. And he had this hierarchy, but many monks said, no, you can't do that. And the monks were right. So we don't actually have a hierarchy. Yeah, you have the father is an elder brother. That's a Chinese sort of culture. But that hierarchy is not authoritarian. Well, I suppose it is in a sense, but original Buddhism was unhierarchical. Many people don't actually know that democracy did not start in Greece, as Western historians want to say. But in the time of the Buddha, the ancient scriptures are very clear there were many old democracies in India 2,500 years ago, contemporary with Athens, Sparta, all those democracies. We're not quite sure, because there was no geographic, there's no connection between those geographical separated states at that time. It was, you know, pre-Alexander the Great. That actually created a connection between those two great civilizations. And still the Chinese were still over the mountains and weren't connected. The Silk Trade hadn't really started yet. But there was democracy, apparently an ancient democracy in India at the same time as in Greece. And the Buddha modeled his monastic organization around the democratic model. And in a democracy, there is sort of a hierarchy in a sense. You know, there is a leader like an abbot, but the abbot hasn't got absolute power. But there's no real strong hierarchy. And that's always been the case, sort of, in most Buddhism. So we cannot impose things on people. And certainly being a Westerner and finding that model, I was very comfortable with that. And perhaps even enhancing that old model here in places like Australia. You find that's far more liberating. It's more difficult. Personally speaking, especially for those who've known me a long time, it's much easier being an abbot in Thailand, in a place where there is more understanding of hierarchy, than here in Australia. Because the monks argue with me no end. They'd never do that if I was in Thailand. But I'm more happy with that sort of model. Yeah. There's as many different types of Buddhism as there are Buddhists, obviously. Because everybody has their own little take. Generally speaking, there are three main types. Usually this is the tradition. There's a Theravada, which is closest to the original Buddhism, Mahayana, which grew up later in China especially, Tibetan Buddhism, which was supposed to be a branch of Mahayana, but because Tibet got invaded by China, and all the Tibetan monks came over to the West, Tibetan Buddhism is quite well known in the world. If the Chinese hadn't invaded, Tibetan Buddhism would still be in Tibet and wouldn't be so well known here. Same with Vietnamese Buddhism. The reason why Vietnamese Buddhism is probably the dominant Buddhism in Australia is because many Vietnamese migrated here after the Vietnam War. But the Theravada Buddhism, that's a Buddhism which grew up in Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand and places like that. And I always say that Thailand is probably the purest form of Theravada Buddhism because the country was never colonized. So it never actually had the cultures of the West imposed upon it. If ever you go to Thailand, you know it's a very liberal country. You know, almost anything goes there, and it's very non-violent. The last coup, which was in Thailand a couple of weeks ago, was a case in point. Just no one got killed. The tanks came out on the street, and that very day, all the tourists were out getting their photographs with the tanks. And all the soldiers, they're supposed to be fighting a coup, or posing in front of the cameras. But the story which really, I always say, just actually shows the Buddhist attitude to such things, was told to me by a friend who was in Laos 35 years ago during the Vietnam War. Actually, I'll tell you a couple of stories of this. This is really funny. He was an English monk, English guy, and he was married to an American girl, just Western capitalists. And they're in the town of Luang Prabang, which is the second city. They've been in there a while. Actually, he confessed to me he was a drug runner. He made a bit of money, and he was actually living a nice life, investing some of his money in all sorts of stuff, and living in Luang Prabang, having a nice time. Basically, it's a third world country, a very nice country, and he thought he'd settle down and have enough money just to hang out for the rest of his life. But then the war came along, and he said he was in one of these old cafes, you know, like bamboo and thatch, but served, you know, really delicious food. He was in there having lunch one day. He noticed on one of the other tables were the government troops. They were also having lunch. And the government, the royalist soldiers. And he almost dived under the table when he saw the communists come in with their guns. Pathet Lao. These were having a war together. But before he could dive under the table to protect himself from the shootout, he saw the communist troops go to another table, put their guns against the wall and order their lunch. Because in Laos, wars stop for lunch, which is much more important. So there's no fighting. This was lunchtime, for goodness sake. And he said he stayed on after the communists took over. But he said that one day, he caught like a little burglar in his house trying to steal things, this young boy. And coming from a British public school, he thought the thing to do was to put him over his knee and give him a spanking, which he did. But then the boy complained to the major, who was the head military man in Luang Prabang, or in that district of Luang Prabang. And he was summoned to see the communist major. And he was really scared because, you know, he was a Westerner. This was a communist government, and he thought he'd get shot or something. But he had to go there. And the fellow said, look, this that might have been okay, you know, in a public school in England, but this is communism, this is Laos, you can't do that anymore. He said, I've got to give you a punishment. I say about punishment. And he braced himself for something terrible to happen. And the communist major said, you will have to hold a party for 3 days and pay for it for everybody. And he said, really? I said, that's okay, I'll take that. But can I come as well? He said, oh, you can come as well, but you have to pay for it all. And that was his punishment in communist Laos. Whether a communist or whatever, they like fun more than anything else. And they knew he was wealthy, so he said, okay, the excuse for you to hold a party. So for 3 days, they all got drunk. And I don't know what else they did there for 3 days. But he had to pay for it all. It's not exactly a punishment that fits the crime. But it was just an excuse to get someone to pay for a party. Yeah. It is a hard thing to do, but it's the only thing to do. There's an old Chinese saying, to love the tiger, but at a distance. So, you know, sometimes some people are just so hard, that you can be kind to them, but you've got to withdraw. So you don't go up to them and say that I'm gay, love me. You just withdraw, but, you know, never take your love away from them. They can take it away from you, but you never take it away from them. You wear them down, as you have done. And that's why I really praise the gay and lesbian community for working so hard to get to where you are. There's many sacrifices. So when the gay pride breakfast last year, I always remember that, forget who was, the gay activist from Tasmania who repealed the gay anti-gay laws over there. Those of you who don't know that story, this fellow, I forget what his name was now, but that's right, yeah. Rodney, there was a law in Tasmania that if you had a homosexual relation, sexual, it was against the law, it was an imprisonable offence. So I think he did some activism to try and repeal the law, but the government said, no, we don't want to repeal it, it's just too hard. You know what governments are like. So he decided to have some affirmative action with his mates. They all had sex that night, and they listed exactly what they did in detail, and they all went to the police station the following morning to hand themselves in with the press behind them. So the police were put in this embarrassing position. They'd done a crime which was on the books, but, you know, that to say prosecute us, come on, And I remember him saying this. He was just really shit scared when he went in there because he didn't know whether he would actually go to jail. He put himself on the line with many, many of his friends. But the press were there, and eventually it was passed up to the government, to the premier there, and the premier knew if he authorises prosecution, him and the whole of the people in Tasmania would be completely humiliated. So within 3 months, the prosecutions were never carried through. Within 3 months, the law was repealed. So what a beautiful story that was. How someone actually, they worked hard to make a better world for other people. Put themselves on the line. So I really respected for what he did. And I thought it was very funny the way he told the story. The way he went into that police station and listed in graphic detail exactly what he did. Took about half an hour to read it all out or something. That's brilliant. But if you are rejected, always know you have other people who don't reject you. So never allow one person to spoil your day. And that's obviously in a country like Australia, you've done the hard work, you're on the way up. It's the other countries I'm afraid of. And those are the ones we really have to work hard to change people's attitudes. And it's my responsibility, because I'm supposed to be a religious leader. I give a lot of talks in many places. Doing pretty well, I think, in Singapore now. Because the previous Prime Minister, Goh Chok Tong, he came out and said, gays are welcome in Singapore. Which was brilliant, because he had some authority. And just afterwards, someone asked a question, I used my clout to say, yeah, Buddhism and gays, Buddhist, which is the majority religion in Singapore, fully embraces gays, no problem at all. And you should never discriminate. That's anti-Buddhist. So I used my reputation in Singapore to really make a strong statement there, backing the Prime Minister. And his actually wife was there when I was saying these things. So obviously got back to him. But he's now just a senior minister now, and Lee Kuan Yew's son is now the Prime Minister. But little by little, you give that freedom to people. Because you know what it's like. I don't know how long you've been a gay in Australia, but you know how it was 10, 20 years ago. And in many places, they're not even that close to freedom yet. So it takes a while. It should never take a while. The sooner the better. There's a freedom for everybody. Any other question or comments any of you have? Yeah. Buddhist take on war, obviously a big mistake. And there is an alternative. And Buddhism has never gone to war for their religion. And that's actually one of the wonderful things which made me proud to be a Buddhist. There has never been a crusade or a war to spread Buddhism. And this probably summed up by Gandhi's attitude. He said, I can see 1,000 reasons to give my life for a cause, but I can't see one reason to take the life of another. And that's basic Buddhism. But sometimes people say, yes, but that's impractical. And I usually quote the following story, which I wrote in the book, Opening the Door of the Heart. A true story of what happened in Thailand after the Vietnam War. Thailand was a Buddhist country. Sometimes it acts like a Buddhist country. Often it doesn't. But in this particular case, after Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam fell within days, all the governments in Bangkok thought that Thailand was coming next. It was called the domino theory. So I was in Thailand at that time when Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam fell as a young monk. The place where I was a monk, if you draw a line between Bangkok and Hanoi and you go 2/3 the way, that's where my monastery was. much closer to Hanoi than it was to Bangkok, in Ubon. So the embassies contacted us about 4 or 5 years. It was an evacuation plan. They expected the communists to come through. The government did. But by that time, I was fluent in Thai and in Laotian. And my teacher, Ajahn Chah, was becoming famous. And many senior politicians and generals would come to him and ask questions. And very often I'd be there listening and overhearing exactly what was going on. I had like an inside knowledge of the situation. The generals in the command of the army weren't at all worried about the communists in Laos and Cambodia surrounding Thailand, because they knew they had exhausted all of their resources capturing those countries. They were regrouping, getting themselves established in those countries. They didn't have enough energy or resources to invade another country. But what they were really concerned about, the big worry, and it was serious, were there were many Thai, especially students, who were disaffected with the government, who had left their universities and their villages and towns, were in the jungles, in an indigenous Thai communist army, the insurgents. And many areas of Thailand were called pink areas, controlled by the communists. And these weren't Laotian or Vietnamese or Cambodian, Khmer Rouge. These were Thais. They were getting their training and their armaments over the border from the communists. They were getting their food from the local villagers. And now that really was a big problem. And it was touch and go for many years whether that insurgency would grow and take over the country. That's what the generals were worried about. And at that time, I used to go wandering in the remote areas of Thailand, because as a monk, you go to the mountains and the forest to meditate. And I had to really be careful, because if I ran into those communists, they would kill me, usually after torturing. That's what they'd done to many monks. So when I was wandering, you'd meet the soldiers, and you'd ask them, where are the communists? Because they'd be on patrol in the jungles. And they point to the mountain. The communists are over there. That mountain is free. You can actually meditate up there. They know some nice caves over there. So they're really, really helpful. But I was wondering, if you know where they are, why didn't you go and do something? That's what you'd think that they would do. But that was not the policy. The policy for many, many years in Thailand was non-violence. Even though they knew where the communist bases were, where they were doing their training, where they were living, they would never go in with their superior armaments, with their jets, with their artillery and bomb. Because they knew if you kill one communist, you make 3, 4, 5 more. Friends, relations, who want to avenge the death of someone they love. And you make the others more committed. They had non-violence. Even though many soldiers got killed, ambushed by the communists, the soldiers would never retaliate. Forgiveness. Non-violence. Actually, the forgiveness was something more, because they had an amnesty. A no-questions-asked amnesty, which was lasting for many, many, many years. If you wanted to give up your guns, doesn't matter if you kill somebody, give them up, go back to school, go back to university, go back to your village. No questions asked. So there was an honorable way out. You always have to give your opposition an honorable way out if you want to stop the problem. If there's no honor for the other person, then they'll always keep fighting or keep sticking their heels in. Even in an argument you have with your partner, please give them an honorable way out. If the only way out is embarrassment, then they're never going to give in. And lastly, the old story, the root problem. I know that sometimes that word has been used overmuch, but that is important. Why were these young people, these Thais, fighting the government? One of the most obvious reasons was poverty. So the government went in to solve the problem. simple solutions like putting roads into the village. With the roads came electricity and usually a clinic and a school. But also, not just bringing resources in, it meant the villagers could export their produce to the nearest market and get some money. At the same time, the king of Thailand in particular spent a lot of his personal resources putting in irrigation schemes. Now, little dams and reservoirs, and using the water in the fields so the villagers could grow a second crop. So those areas started to become prosperous. Villagers realized that people cared in Bangkok for them. And one soldier I always remember meeting, when I asked him, how's it going? He said, look, I'm on patrol at the foot of the mountain. The communists are up there, I know who they are. Because they come down every now and again to get some rice and food from the village. I say, hi. I never shoot them. I know exactly who they are. All I do, I show them my new watch and my new ghetto blaster. He said, that's, you know, the bullets which I shoot. Prosperity. And it worked. Non-violence, forgiveness or amnesty, addressing the root problem, three-pronged solution. One by one, they gave themselves up. Gave up their guns, went back to the village or universities and carried on. Until there was so few people in the jungles that even the leaders gave themselves up. The insurgency just withered away. And I remember reading a copy of Bangkok Post, and some bright entrepreneur was actually taking Thai tourists to the caves where the headquarters of the insurgency was, making a tidy profit. But the best part of this story, the one which really inspired me, was when the leaders gave themselves up. The top generals, the ones who organized this, the treason makers. And I sort of wondered, what would the government do to these guys? Does forgiveness go all the way to the top? Answer was, you can't just give forgiveness in the ordinary way to these leaders. They were given amnesty, they weren't put in jail or shot. But instead, they were offered very senior positions in the government civil service. The Thai government realized these people were highly committed, very organized, hard-working, self-sacrificing. Why put them against a wall and shoot them? Let's make use of these people. Have them work for us. Get their ideas in our government. So the leaders were given top positions. When I left Thailand, that was the end of the story. A few years ago, I told that story in Sydney, and the Thai consul of Sydney was in the audience listening. And he stood up afterwards, question time, and said, all you said is true, but there's been later developments since you left Thailand. He said, two of those radicals, he called them, leaders of the communist insurgency, he said, and now serving ministers in the Thai government, have risen to the rank of a minister and are now using their energies to help their country. That's how you stop a war. So, what I think, the way to stop Al-Qaeda is to invite Osama bin Laden, give him full amnesty, and invite him to, say, be the treasurer of Grey Pride Week, because he's got a lot of money. Get people on board, rather than keeping them out. As President Lyndon Baird Johnson, sometimes the American presidents say some wise things. One of his favorite sayings, and I really remember this, it's better to have your enemy in the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. It's a great saying, that. Better have the in the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. So bring your enemy inside your tent. Okay, it's about 6:30, and I think that many of you have got other things to do this evening. I know that you're not monks or nuns, so you're not going to be like me going back to the monastery this evening. It's Saturday night, after all. So, again, thank you for inviting me to give this talk this evening. I hope I haven't said anything at all in any which way which is offensive to anybody whatsoever. I try to present Buddhism in a way which I understand it traditionally and also personally. And wish you the best of luck and have a great time. Very good. Okay, so those of you who want to have a cup of tea or something, that's available next door. Hopefully, isn't it, Lynn? Okay. And otherwise, have a great night. Have a great Grey Pride Week.